Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. You can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, singer-songwriter Robin Rogers on her surreal mix of high and lows she's encountered this past year. Her new album is a hit, but she has also been battling cancer. Author Daniel Evans talks about her wonderful new collection of short stories called Before You Suffocate, Your Own Fool Self. And we remember a jazz icon, saxophonist and flautist James Moody. But first,
we have the latest now in our series about hit makers, the people who create and sell chart-topping songs. Today, NPR's Zoe Chase takes us to New York to visit producer Jerry Wunda Duplessis. He's been turning out platinum records for 15 years, and he's going to walk us through one of his latest projects, Step by Step.
How does a hit song start? Right, piano intro. Lots of big songs open with piano.
That piano, there's a lot of things we add to it to make it that smoky, zony, vibey, but hard when the drums drop.
If you're trying to make a number one record, you begin in a room like this one. Jerry Wunda built Platinum Sound Studios 10 years ago. He says it's the loudest studio in New York City. Everything you could possibly use to build a song is in here, like Julia Child's kitchen. Jerry Wunda is the top producer at Platinum Sound, Serge Tsai, the top engineer. There's an enormous soundboard as big as a rug with 80-plus faders on it, keyboards, bass, a box labeled Auto-Tune, two soft couches, and a MacBook. Now, where were we?
Headphones back on.
Bring the piano back in.
Now, what we add in now, you hear that little clap? Stadium sound.
Many of today's hit songs start with a track. Instrumental music first, before there's any concept of what the song will be about or even who will sing it. I asked Wunda where he got the clapping sounds. The answer really surprised me.
I would go in there, do a bunch of tracks.
Wait, that's actually people's hands?
Yeah, people's hand. And we have different sonnets.
He stores the sound in a vast library of what he calls sonic, the way you'd grow sage in your garden and store the dried leaves in your spice cabinet. On this song, he uses the sonic to create a feeling that you're in a stadium.
Now I hear the drums. And once we get it to a level, sometime I get a writer to come in to write the lyrics and melodic on the top of the song.
For this particular song, the writer is R&B superstar John Legend. Wunda played the track for Legend.
He's like, oh my God, oh, I love this, oh, oh my God. And he just went and created a crazy hook on it.
The hook is often the most important element of a pop song. It's the part you remember, that you sing at the top of your lungs at a baseball game or at prom.
Now, let's add John Legend vocals right here, just to show a little.
Take me to that old familiar place. Take me to memories we won't erase.
But even someone like John Legend, an accomplished vocalist, needs a dose of that sonic. Not auto-tune to correct his pitch. As Wunda says, real singers don't need that.
The only thing we add in John is a nice verb and a delay.
To all that we had, good and the bad, I'll never forget you. I'll never let you go. I'll never forget you.
How much reverb and delay is on John Legend's voice? How much sonic to make this song sound like a pop song? Just enough. Like adding salt to a dish, says engineer Serge Tsai.
You know you don't put a handful of salt in your food. So it's kind of a similar thing.
Now Wunda has a music bed, a melody, and a hook.
In the middle, you leave an empty the space to rap on it.
Jerry Wunda sent over a sound file to rapper Lupe Fiasco. It had three blank spaces, 12 measures long, for Fiasco to rap over. And this is what he sent back, without ever stepping into a studio with John Legend.
Yeah. And let the evidence show, the future's so bright, it's never been known, not like like tonight. We walk into the glow, right into the light. The past all around us, the time of our life. The first love.
There's only one thing left for Jerry Wonder to do. Test the record for that stadium sound. To make sure he got the sonic right for where this song is going to be played. So he takes the headphones off and turns the volume up as loud as it goes. And he plays it loud as Madison Square Garden.
The verb and that little delay and a vocal, we say I make it big. That little verb and that delay. And John Legend, the sonic.
According to Wanda, without that sonic, you don't have a global hit.
A producer is the person that really create, I call, the foundation of a song infrastructure. Because it's all about the sonic. That's what a producer, in my world, that's what I do.
Take me to that old familiar place. Take me to memories we won't erase.
Never Forget You will be the second single released off Lupe Fiasco's new album. Zoe Chace, NPR News.
Fiction writer Danielle Evans burst onto the literary scene in 2007 when her first short story was published in the Paris Review. At the time, she was just 23. Now, she's released her debut book. It's a collection of short stories called Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self. Evans grew up moving from city to city with her mother. She writes about some of those places, New York, Tallahassee, Northern Virginia, and about navigating those worlds from the perspectives of mixed-race and African-American teenagers. The stories have a fly-on-the-wall quality, as if you're listening in on private conversations about race and gender and class. But when she stopped by our studios recently, Evans told me she doesn't want her characters to be defined by only those things.
Part of what I'm interested in is that we're in this weird moment racially where we're certainly not post anything, but that there are opportunities in the present that people could not have been prepared for by the past.
Opportunities to talk about race in a straightforward way?
That, but I'm thinking more on the level of the actual stories themselves. Hmm. I mean, things like the tensions that arise in interracial relationships aren't anymore, that you have to kind of go to a different state because it's illegal and hope nobody kills you most of the time. But then the fact that those aren't the pressures opens up an entire other range of possibilities, right? And so the more intricate, kind of messy, your personal stuff, which people cannot have been prepared for by the past because it wasn't as plausible in the past. Things like people being asked to go back and forth between two or three worlds and in a way that, you know, those worlds would not have been open to them at all previously. And so I think a lot of what it comes down to is people having to go back and forth, and not just in the sense of being interracial, but also between different class settings, between different voices even.
Growing up, you had to, and presumably you still, well, all of us sort of shift from one world to the next world. Sometimes you were the only African-American kid in a school of white kids, for example.
Often, yes. They'd move me from the school that I started at to the magnet school for gifted children. And I think I was literally the only kid in my class who didn't have blue eyes. I think I was the only black child in the gifted and talented program in all of Fairfax County that particular year.
You write about a high school, the fictional high school, the Robert E. Lee High. Can you tell us about this story?
Yeah. The framework for that story is that there is this school where there's this kind of tracking in place, which I think is true in a lot of parts of the country for various reasons. It's true in various parts of the South that there were gifted programs devised partly as a matter of educational opportunity, but partly because people were terrified of their kids having to go to school with minorities. Mm. And that was a lot of the ways that they got around integration orders was, okay, everyone will physically be in the same building, but there's no way they're going to be in the same classroom. Mm. So that's the sort of structural backdrop for the story. But part of what I was thinking about on the level of character is, you know, how these two teenage girls kind of navigate that.
Crystal and Gina. Crystal is a sort of the talented, good student. She's going to become the valedictorian. Gina is her friend who sort of gets into a lot of trouble. Both of them are African-American girls in a predominantly white school.
I mean, and I was thinking about two things with that story. One, I wanted to play with that narrative because we often do have this kind of simplistic good kid, bad kid narrative. And I think there's a way in which the people who get marked as exceptions kind of need the people who are the rule to function. And so I was thinking about that dynamic and that way in which, you know, there's a point in the story in which Crystal says, Gina had already made me possible, and therefore the implication is I don't need her anymore.
Mm. As it becomes clear that Crystal will become the valedictorian and she's sort of on the up and up at the school, Gina stops talking to her. Can you read a passage from the book?
Sure. I'm just going to read this is a paragraph at the end of a scene where Crystal has just gotten some news from the guidance counselor about what she's going to do that summer. I let the promise of summer comfort me while Gina avoided me. Violetta and April became Gina's new best girlfriends. I was somewhat consoled by the fact that it took two people to replace me. V made a point of telling everyone that she'd gone to middle school with me, and I'd been a bougie bitch then, too. I started to eat lunch in the library again. If Gina thought she could make me lonely enough to change my mind about summer school, she'd vastly underestimated my capacity for loneliness. I'd perfected lonely in the third grade.
How do you think about getting into the heads of high school girls and sort of capturing that internal dialogue?
I mean, in some sense, teenagers are wonderful for fiction because I had a teacher once who said that the trick to fiction is to start with a scenario and have your character say yes to everything a reasonable person would say no to. And I think teenagers say yes to a lot of things that reasonable people would say no to because either they don't know any better, they're kind of
or they're reckless.
Testing, or they're deliberately saying yes to things as a way of sort of making some declaration about themselves to the world. But I didn't want the decisions made that seemed questionable or bad to be decisions made in the absence of logic. And so I wanted to give the teenage characters enough credit for there being some internal logic at play, which teenagers in general, and teenage girls in particular, I think get culturally written off a lot. Like anything having to do with teenage girls is presumed to be silly or ephemeral. And so I wanted to think about how to take them seriously and how to have characters making mistakes, but making them in a way that didn't make them unintelligent.
Do you in some ways have to identify with the narrator in order to tell the story from that perspective?
Not always. I mean, I think to some degree you identify with almost every character you write because you created them. But, I mean, sometimes I think it's fun with the first person to actually tell the story of a person that you don't understand. I think the first person who's surprised by the story has to be me, or otherwise it just doesn't materialize on the page. And so sometimes there are narrators who, you know, what I'm really doing is trying to tell their story so I can figure out what their story is, or so they can figure out what they're thinking or how they're thinking about it.
Danielle Evans, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Danielle Evans' collection of short stories is called Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self. For our Best Books of 2010 series, Danielle Evans chose her favorite works of outsider fiction. You can find her selections at npr.org.
Robin Rogers is a blues singer in Charlotte, North Carolina. And this fall, some friends and musicians threw a benefit concert for her because Robin Rogers has a cancerous tumor in her liver. Like a lot of musicians, she has no health insurance to cover her care in a hospice. The concert was a huge outpouring of love and support for her. And now Robin Rogers has a brand new album on Blind Pig Records that's a hit on the blues charts. It's called Back in the Fire. Second Time Around from the CD Back in the Fire with Robin Rogers on vocals and harmonica. Robin Rogers joins us now from member station WFAE in Charlotte. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And let me ask you first, how are you doing?
Oh, that's a loaded question. Every day is different. I have a lot of side effects from the Nescavar that I'm taking. So if anyone's been on chemotherapy, they know how dreadful it is. Yeah. So I'm hanging in there, buddy. I'm fighting.
Got to tell you, Miss Rogers, reading your biography could have been taken from a blues song. We're what we call a runaway as a teenager.
Correct.
Slept in abandoned cars, I gather.
Correct.
You were in reform.
Homeless.
You were in reform school.
Right.
Not a stranger to drugs or drink.
Right.
But you've been sober for 20 years, right?
21. It'll be 22 in February.
So does that give you a lot to make music about?
Oh, absolutely. That's where everything pretty much comes from. And a lot of the songs I think are healing because I'm trying to heal, you know, physically and spiritually. And so it's definitely a story of my life.
Let's hear some more music if we could. Let's listen to The Plan.
Great.
Well, I come too far to look back now. Just a little bit of faith, turn it all around. I couldn't feel much better, even if I tried.
So what does that lyric mean to you now, everything is going as planned?
Well, it has a different meaning. When I wrote that, I really didn't know how sick I was. And, you know, it's taken on a couple of meanings for me. But it's pretty much true. I mean, everything that I've done, got a little red house. I bought a house here in Charlotte area 20 years ago. And I got a lot of friends, and I'm very blessed. And, yeah, it has a different meaning now since I'm, you know, been diagnosed terminal, so.
Yeah. You co-wrote much of this album with your husband, Tony Rogers, who also plays the guitar.
Wonderful, wonderful musician, amazing songwriter, songwriting partner. You know, he's everything. He's taking care of me now. I made him unemployed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, he wants to be with you. He's doing what he wants to do.
I want him there. I would want no one else there. Yeah, he's my everything. It's like air smells better now. You know, water tastes good. It's just a sweet departure.
Yeah. So tell me, please, about the opening track, Baby Bye Bye.
A song kind of based on a guy who does a girl wrong and she stands up, you know, she's strong, and tells him, hit the road, no more.
Bye, bye, baby, baby, bye, bye. You ain't gonna steal my pride. Bye, bye, baby, baby, bye, bye.
Oops. So it's just so... man bashing song.
a bad man bashing song.
Yeah, she got into this crazy relationship, and that's not me, of course, because I'm happily married. We've been together 16. Yeah, we've been happily married. I hope you'll say that too. I feel like we're in a wedding, the newlywed game.
That's a good song.
Thank you.
We're speaking with Robin Rogers. Her new album is Back in the Fire. You able to sing and play much now?
I've been working on it a little bit at home, and I'm trying to just really concentrate right now on fighting this tumor, because I'm trying to come at it from all angles, you know, spiritual and physical and mental. You know, it's a lot for a person to be told to have a year to live, so... I catch myself thinking about the past and looking at the future, which is kind of something I was taught in the program, the 12-step program, is you don't really think too far ahead other than day at a time. And that's surely helped me, but it has changed a little bit because I do have to think about the future and fighting. And so I've been concentrating on that instead of so much the music right now.
Yeah. Let me ask you about kind of a change of pace that you have on this album. Your cover of Little Willie John's Need Your Love So Bad. One reviewer said, I'm going to share this phrase before we hear it, quote, Robin's voice cracks in all the right places, making the ache of desire palpable.
I need someone's hands to lead me through the night. I need someone's arms to hold and squeeze me tight. And when the night begins and until it ends, oh, I need your love so bad.
You able to enjoy the success this album has had?
Not as much as I'd like to. You know, I haven't even toured behind the record, so it's amazing that it's this successful.
There's one more cut we'd like to listen to,
mm-hmm.
and that's the final track of the CD, What We're Worth. Now, I hope you don't mind if I ask a couple of questions that the tune seems to suggest, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I realize that you recorded this before you knew quite how sick you were. Do you pray?
Yes, sir. Every day. I was mad there when I got out of the hospital for a while. I was kind of angry, but I worked through several of those emotions, and now I'm back to reading my meditations and 12-step stuff, and it helps a lot. Just substitute alcohol for cancer,
yeah.
in the literature. So,
and is there something you can share with us that you've learned?
Yeah, I've learned that record labels are not all greedy and mean and like Mr. Scrooge, over in the corner counting their beans. Blind Pig has been amazing. They've been totally amazing with all of this. And, I've learned that time is fleeting. You need to do everything you can do while you have a chance.
Well, there are a lot of people in your corner, Miss Rogers.
Thank you. I'm sorry I got choked up there.
That's all right.
A couple of times. It's just hard. It's hard news,
Well, thanks for all the time you've spent with us, okay?
Oh, you're quite welcome. And I know there's a bunch of people I should thank, but my memory ain't what it used to be, but maybe it will be in a couple of days if I get off this stuff.
Yeah.
The chemo.
I hope so.
Thank you.
Robin Rogers in Charlotte, her new CD on Blind Pig, Back in the Fire.
Where we all need somebody.
Saxophonist and composer James Moody has died. The veteran jazzman will forever be remembered for this. Moody's Mood for Love has been covered by George Benson, Van Morrison, and Queen Latifah, among many others. James Moody was also known for his soulful saxophone playing and for mentoring younger musicians. He died in San Diego yesterday of pancreatic cancer. He was 85 years old. NPR's Walter Ray Watson has this remembrance.
James Moody's life began with challenges. As he told WHYY's Fresh Air in 1996, he was born partially deaf, and he spoke with a lisp.
It doesn't mean that I have a speech impediment. It's just that I don't hear S's. My wife always tells me when I'm singing Mood for Love, I say, you give me a smile, and it sounds like you're saying you give me a mile.
Such a funny thing, but every time you need me, I never can behave. You give me a smile and then I'm wrapped up in your magic.
Moody couldn't hear certain high notes as a child, but as he told NPR in 1997, he would stand outside the windows of his neighborhood music store in Newark, New Jersey, a lot.
And I used to look at the saxophones every day. I just look at them, And when I first got my first saxophone, I put it in bed by me and went to sleep with it, man. I was just looking at it, boy.
His uncle bought him that secondhand alto when he was 16. He mostly taught himself to play. His first real musical training came as a member of the Negro Air Force Band, an unofficial group formed in his segregated unit during World War II. That's where Dizzy Gillespie heard and hired him. He played 3 years with Gillespie, but an early addiction problem sent him to recover at his uncle's home in Paris.
So I went to Paris to stay for 2 weeks and stayed 3 years.
In 1949, using a borrowed alto saxophone, Moody improvised over the chord changes to the pop song I'm in the Mood for Love. His version never stated the melody, but it inspired a couple of jukebox hits.
And what happened was the instrumental was a hit first, and then King Pleasure sang the vocal version, and that became a hit.
You give me a smile and then I'm wrapped up in your magic.
The song became a hit in large part because of the way another singer, Eddie Jefferson, skillfully turned Moody's saxophone solo into lyrics.
Come into with me, any little thing you want to. Anything, baby, just let me get next to you.
Moody's Mood for Love became James Moody's calling card. He came back to the U.S. and got a new lease on life.
He'll play a solo. You're sitting there listening to it and say, wow. And then Moody will come over to you on the side of the stage and look up and say, was that all right?
John Faddis says that's typical of Moody's humility. He first met the saxophonist when Faddis was a teenager.
I know younger musicians like Antonio Hart and myself will look at Moody and see someone who is always searching and learning more about music and life and is always willing to share what he knows with others.
Moody's generosity extended to his audience. He was a showman at concerts, making crowds laugh with his self-deprecating honesty.
And the thing about it, ladies and gentlemen, is this is the way I am. If I make a mistake, like, that's me, and I do it because, you see, making mistakes is being perfect. I'm serious, because I'm perfectly me. You see what I mean?
And James Moody was a lot more than his best-known song. Walter Ray Watson, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.